The Nana. The Nana, it's the drone. But people from Gaza, people of Gaza, they give it the name Zanana. Why? You know, in Dutch, Zag. So it's almost, this is the meaning of Zanana, because it keeps making this noise the whole day, 24/7. So that's why people say Zanana. It didn't stop. So, I forget after leaving Gaza until it find a place inside my mind, and I couldn't get it out, not yet.
The podcast van EPO.
Fatina Al-Ghorra is een Palestijnse schrijfster, dichteres en journaliste uit Gaza. In haar nieuw verschenen boek Uittocht naar Gaza schrijft ze brieven naar haar lievelingsnichtje Lamar. Eind september 2023, na 15 jaar, trok Fatina terug naar haar familie in Gaza. Op bezoek, zo was het plan. Wie had kunnen denken dat ze enkele weken later vast zou komen te zitten in het Al-Quds ziekenhuis in Gaza City, samen met 14.000 andere Palestijnen op de vlucht voor de massale en agressieve bombardementen van het Zionistisch leger van oorlogsmisdadiger Netanyahu. Schrijven is voor Fatina meer dan leven. Een woord is als een adem. Ze spreekt drie talen, waaronder Nederlands, schrijft in het Arabisch, voelt zich voor een interview het best thuis in het Engels.
I was a television anchor and radio anchor when I was in Gaza. That was my profession, and I kept writing for several newspapers about literature mainly. And then I worked for Al Jazeera like 8 years, something like this, as a reporter from Belgium. It's part of who I am, actually. For me, I have multi-identity, let's say. Words and using words as an item. For me, it's through two different ways, writing poetry or literature or journalism. So both of them, for me, it's part of who I am. I live here for 15 years in Belgium. I left Gaza 15 years, or now it's almost 16 years. And I tried, since I received my Belgian nationality, to go back to Gaza, which I couldn't until before the genocide. While I was here, I had two books already published in Dutch. Here in Holland, and I organized for several years here in Belgium Fatina Poetry Salon, where I hosted poets from both cultures, also combined with music or sometimes singing. So, and also I am a poetry translator from Dutch to Arabic and from English.
Fatina Poetry Salon, it's a kind of a tradition in the Arabic culture. And normally, it's a salon hosted by females poets. And it's to like build a bridge between the Arabic culture and the Dutch culture, the Belgian culture. I think it will be the best message that no matter how we look different, seems different, but poetry and literature can bring us together.
De liefde voor literatuur, poëzie en Palestina brengen Fatina ver weg van huis. Bescheiden als ze is, vertelt ze nauwelijks over de internationale prijzen en waardering. Het vele reizen en optreden en vooral dat knagend gevoel duwen haar in een burn-out. En dan wordt duidelijk wie en wat ze mist. Gaza. Ze beslist na 15 jaar terug te gaan naar haar Gaza City. Na een korte tussenstop in Egypte stapt ze op de nachtbus naar Gaza. Maar bij het aankomen in Gaza City gebeurt er iets vreemd.
That was one of the most difficult feelings I have ever tests in my life. It was like losing myself in a way, losing the way to myself in a way. Being in the car and moving around several times in our neighborhood, in our street, without being able to define where's our home, that was really scary for me. And that was a sign that I was really so long away. I've been so long away. I didn't realize that because I'm always in a connect with my family in Gaza. So I didn't realize how long it's been for me to be away from Gaza until I miss the way I lost the way to go home. Yes. So, but I could finally, with the help of my nieces and nephews who were outside and looking and searching, and then they saw the car. Oh, and that moment was like heaven. The whole time, tears from joy, from happiness, from not being able to realize that I'm really here in our home. I'm really here among my family, my nieces, my nephews. We finally looked at each other without being distracted by bad connection or not clear photo or small screen. So suddenly I am inside the family, and all of them, they were surrounding me. So many talks and a moment for my whole life to remember.
How come that you went back to Gaza after 15 years? 15 years is very long.
Indeed. It's very, very long. Well, it was not my first try to go to Gaza. I became a Belgian in 2016. And since that date, almost every year I try to enter Gaza, but for so many reasons I couldn't succeed. I understood why when I could finally reach Gaza, but why I couldn't before.
And why was it?
I think because of the experience that I lived. It gives more value to my experience, being away that long. There is so many meanings behind it. Some of them I could comprehend, some of them maybe in the future I will comprehend why. But for me, it's like I think finally I could succeed going there. For me, it was like a message from the universe. Like, we chose you. The universe said, I chose you to do this mission. I wasn't informed about it before, but I took the responsibility, I took the risk. I knew it. Since it happened, I knew it. So for me, it's like to give more credibility to my statement, maybe, or my testimony. So there's so many meanings. To see Gaza after being ready, maybe, for what it's come. Yeah.
Do you know anything about that? What can you report at this stage? All right. Yumna, please take cover. If you are in a position to do so safely, you can explain to us what we're happening. If you are not in a position to do so safely,
yes,
then please get to safety.
No, it's okay. This is a missile attack on Palestine Tower, right in the middle of Gaza City.
Yumna, take a moment to breathe.
Nobody could imagine that was not the scenario, like to destroy some places, some buildings, or no, to have this massive destruction for the whole Gaza. Nobody were thinking about it. So that's why the decision to stay at home, because, okay, we will be safe. They will, like, destroy, like, buildings related to Hamas and et cetera. And people are familiar of this. But when we kept hearing about what happens in the south and in the north, and how people run away from there and evacuate to hospitals in Gaza and Gaza City and other hospitals and schools. My brother who's here and in America, they were thinking to take us away from Gaza and to go to the south. So at that moment, there was a big discussion inside our home because we are more than 60. So to take all of this number of people, that was not possible under the circumstances, and it was risky to move all together. So we start moving, like my brother, the older brother, he took the decision to take his family, but also a big numbers, to the south. And then for us, my brother, he said that there is two flats are ready for you in the south. We thought we will not leave. We'll stay home. And it's too far. And why to go to Khan Yunis and blah, blah, blah. So they were asking me, what do you think? And for me, everybody should be responsible for his own decision. It's not a time to tell people what to do. It's a huge responsibility. One word can means life of a huge part of your family. So you cannot be responsible in their decisions. So we let everybody take their own decision, and that's why we stick inside our house for 2 weeks after the genocide began. It was not easy at all, because you don't only hear the bombing outside, you feel it also when your whole building shake so many times. And the voices, I think we need a special therapy to could overcome the effect of the voices in our bodies and in our souls. It doesn't leave your mind, it doesn't leave your memory, it doesn't leave your it doesn't leave you. So the decision came when we were preparing everything. Everything was ready, like small things to take it with us when it's time. And we were waiting for a queue, like a serious queue. And then it came to us. That day was, I think, Friday. They bombed our neighbor. I felt like the whole building is falling apart. And that was our cue to leave the house. And then the basic or the most reasonable thing to do is to go to Al Quds Hospital, because it's in our neighborhood. So we stayed there the whole time until we evacuated from there to Khan Yunis.
It took about a month, I think. But can you, if it's okay for you, to describe, I read in your book, you went to the fourth floor.
Hello, this is Fatina al-Hurra, Al-Quds, Zikin Haas, and Haas. ondanks de oorlog buiten, maar hier het leven is onmenselijk. We slapen op grond, hier, daar. Hier is mijn vader, hier slapen en eten we. De situatie is heel erg, we horen alleen die raketten of die bomberen, maar 10 dagen of meer ben ik hier. Ik nam alleen één keer een douche met één fles van water. Want het water van de kraan is een water van de zee, echt een water van de zee. Mensen hier, ze zijn vervelend, want er is geen privacy. Mensen slapen voor elkaar, eten voor elkaar, vechten voor elkaar, lachen voor elkaar. Geen privacy, dus... ik ben hier met mijn familie, met mijn ouders. Ze zijn ongeveer 80 jaar oud. Wat we hebben nodig, dit oorlog zo snel mogelijk te stoppen. Dit genocide te stoppen. Holocaust, dit holocaust te stoppen. Dit Nakba te stoppen. Dit is wat hebben we nodig. No, actually, I miss that time. Believe it or not. You know, going back, like maybe I said in my book, part of the reasons that I felt that I am this tree and my roots, it's taken off from my ground. So I was thinking that when I go to Gaza, to my childhood areas, schools, friends, beach, restaurants, streets, to rebuild my memory in a reality, with Gaza. That was my idea of reconnecting my roots with Gaza itself. But I was never imagining that it will be reconnected in this way, because in the hospital, I was invited to the houses of people in Gaza, all houses, but not like invited as a guest, invited as a member. So you could see people inside their houses, like to send to Hakias, without wearing masks to have visitors. You know, when we have visitors at home, we dress. We even if we had a fight, we cut with the fight until the people leave our home, and then we return back making fights. And you know, these small details. And suddenly, it was in front of me. I think that was it was the most incredible way to reconnect with my people, by being with them, by living everything they lived, living every single thing that my people lived and my family lived. For me, it was the most privilege that I could receive in my life. I felt so privileged to be there and to live there. There was difficulties, of course. There was challenges, of course. Each single moment, because like I mentioned about time there is so liquid. Sometimes you feel like each day is this just another copy from yesterday. It's the same bombing, it's the same accidents that people get injured in front of the hospital, or while they were walking in one of the corridors, they've been hit by a piece of a racket or something. And sometimes you feel like it's infinite. It's like this day will never end. Dit is Fatina Borra alweer. We zijn terug naar de oorlog.
na zeven, we hebben nog ja, zeven dagen van rust, geen rust hier in Gazastrook. Ik zit vast met mijn familie, met mijn moeder hier, mijn vader ook en mijn twee broeren, met een familie. En we weten niet waar we moeten naartoe. Het is een non-stop genocide. Niemand doet iets. Geen regering of overheid doet iets. Tot wanneer? De vraag is tot wanneer? Tot alle Gaza-mensen verdwenen van dit wereld? Tot Gaza zelf verdwenen van dit wereld? We zoeken alleen mensenrechten. Alleen mensenrechten.
Part of me is still there in the hospital because I didn't leave it yet. I'm still there. I'm still stuck there. Before going to Gaza, I was recovering from the burnout. And Gaza supposedly was the plan to be my last circle in recovery from the burnout that I was suffering from like almost a year before. And the plan with myself, that, this is so ironic. The plan that after coming back from Gaza, I should put leg on leg, relax, I finish all my battles, I'm done with battles, I'm done with fighting, I'm done. Now I have to sit, and this is time of harvesting every single struggle that I went through my whole life. I didn't know that it will be a new chapter, the greatest, actually, chapter of my life. Oh my God, they make me angry so many times. The children, you know, because they were fighting and hitting some balloons to make noise. And I was like, oh my God, give me patience. Ya Allah, give me patience. Because I was living in silence. Suddenly, I'm living in the street, you know, not only a calm street, inside the market, open door market, 24/7 market, so full with people and everything. And not only that, but also bombing. And so it's like all kinds of voices, but the voice of children was so much annoying in a way that once I felt like, please, let me, ya Allah, make them silent. And then my mind just realized what's the meaning of being silent, the children being silent. It means death for them. So I was like, no, please God, no. Let them make this noise. Let them make this noise if it's about it. But it doesn't mean that sometimes I lose my temper. I lost it. And when I lost it, everybody in our floor, they didn't argue with me. I was like, what? Stop! How come you don't do that? You know, just like this, I couldn't handle this noise. And just take your children. Take responsibility of your children. And that's it. But it was difficult also for the families because, you know, it's they couldn't stop them because other people, children, and yeah, it was that was the most difficult thing, if I can say.
But you had a kind of remote control.
Yes.
You name it as a remote control, yes. In your book.
Yes, yes, I name it like this because, you know, sometimes if you want to make people understand what you are describing, give them something they relate to. So the remote control, everybody knows how it works.
With the television?
Yes, everybody knows. Like I'm describing myself right now with a mobile. Like I am a mobile. When I left Gaza, I was fully charged. But my charger is not with me. Now I'm only 10% charge without a charger. So I think this is the way I make to make people understand what I'm going through. So.
But what was your remote control?
My mind. I trained during my time being alone, living alone for so long. I never lived with anybody for my whole life when I left Gaza, since I left Gaza. So being alone, I could train my mind, you know, in a way to talk with my mind and do things together, like, you know. So I was looking for a way to rescue myself because I knew that I need my energy. There are so many people count on me here. Because from the beginning, they were expecting things from me, but they saw other things, like they were expecting me to leave. You know, it doesn't make sense to come back after 15 years and to be killed or to live this. Why? I have nationality, another, like a foreign nationality, so I can't just leave. So, but when they saw me, like, sticking with them and living everything with them, so they start believing in me more and counting on me and so many things. So, that's how I, in a certain moment, I thought I need to gather energy and to take some bad energy away from my body. And the only way I could do that, because there is no privacy, I couldn't have the luxury even to stay in a room. Whenever I need time with myself, I just lay down on the mattress next to the wall that leads to the, like 2 meters away, it's the toilet, and cover myself, the whole of me, with a blanket, just like this, switch off. I'm not here. الجلال والجمال والبهاء والسناء في رباك في رباك والحياة والنجاة والهناء والرجاء في هواك في موطني موطني الشباب لن يكل همه أن يستقل أو يبيت أو يبيت نستقي من الردى ولن نكون للعدا كالعبيد كالعبيد لا نريد لا نريد موتنا المؤكد وعيشنا المنكد ذلنا المؤكد وعيشنا المنكد لا نريد بل نعيد مجدنا التالي مجدنا التالي موتني موتني We are not passenger or passenger by in the history of a human being. We add value to the human being, culture and civilization. We are not just passing by, no. We add philosophy, we add poetry, we add culture, we add music, we add cinema. We have our part of the culture and civilization of the whole world. And it's inside the Palestine and inside them. So it's normal to see so many things in the hospital did by people from Gaza. Singing, dancing, taking off hair eyebrows and cleaning their faces and hairs. And yeah, that was part of the resistance also. Coiffeur who was outside the building, outside the door, who make haircuts for the guys, and even my nephew Abdurrahman, Habibi Abdurrahman, he was like, yani, he's the example of joy, actually, Abdurrahman. And he stood like one day in the middle of the corridor and sitting on a chair and with the gloves from, you know, the medical gloves. And these gloves were given to the children to let them like busy with this. And Abdurrahman, he sat there on the chair, blowing the gloves to be a ball, you know, a balloon, writing over each one of them some words or names for of the children's. So that was joyful, really, lots of joy. And sometimes we did like we give candies to children inside the hospital, making some activities to the children, drawing, dancing, playing, things like this. So yes, we are experts. It has nothing to do with any cultural thing. It has to do with the gene. It's the gene of the land itself, Gaza. Gaza full with stories, full with resistance, and the history of Gaza is full with resistance. Gaza was never in a city that attacked other people, or never. But all the time she was under the attack. But not for one time Gaza gave up or lost hope or didn't fight back or stop resistance. All the time there is resistance. These people, they know that they are free people. They were born free, and they know their history, even if they never went into a school or read a word. They know their history. My mother, she knows her history, and she taught me this history. My grands, they know their history. They never went in school. You know, when you are under occupation and you know that your land is stolen away, and there is a force which supported by the most powerful regimes, countries in the whole world, by all the weapons, and they can erase you just like this. The only thing you do at this moment to keep connecting with your roots, to keep talking about your roots and showing and rebuild every single building or street or memory or anything. The people of Gaza, they are expert doing that, actually.
There will be another president of the United States, and they already selected a Minister of Foreign Affairs, Marco Rubio. He's a very pro-Zionist, pro-Israel man, neoconservative. He also chose his ambassador in Israel, Huckabee, also a settler colonist. So I think you have to write very strong.
Isn't this so silly? Really? You know, because this is really, I think if you want to describe a crazy moment in history, you will not find a better moment to describe than this moment. Like, because everybody knows the history of this man. And he's not a politician. He never worked as a, he is a businessman. And to put a businessman who doesn't consider the lives, we saw him how he fired people with zero tolerance and zero empathy or sympathy. How could you imagine that this kind of man will treat the big issues in the universe, actually, as a leader for the most modern, like modern and democratic governments or countries. So imagine a history of a country like this supports the first country and the most powerful country who supports the genocide and feed the occupation daily of military and weapons to kill innocent children and women. Now, bring us, deliver to the world for the second time, and we could escape the first time from a nuclear war. So now, to give us for the second time this person to lead the modern world. Imagine what is the outcome. Imagine that. So, bullshits. We've been fooled by bullshits for decades. We bought that because it was delivered with a very beautiful package about democracy, about freedom, about free of war, about, you know, and we saw them defending that. We saw them standing for that, but we didn't see the part that they stand for. Who? Ah, okay, you only stand for people who looks like you. So you only believe in human rights when it comes to people like you or people you support. Okay, so it's not unconditional love. No, it's with so much conditions, actually. So, you know, we have an expression, say, in Arabic, كَلِمَةُ حَقٍّ أُرَادُ بِهَا بَاطِلٍ. A word of justice, of a right word, but with an inner meaning of bad. Like when Netanyahu said that it's a battle between the good and evil, and, you know, that's completely right. I am agreeing with every single word that he said. It's a real test for our humanity, for the humanity of the whole world, Gaza. And ironically, if you look to the map, you cannot see it because how small it is in the map. Gaza could do that and make this shake, a weakness shake for the hearts and the conscience of lots of people in the whole world. Put them in a conflict with themselves and which kind of manners they've been taught and they believed in, and suddenly we are witnessing the difference between two things. One of them is the worst scenario of genocide that you can ever make people or force people to live, and one horrible thing like occupied Ukraine by the Russian. But the huge difference between how the modern world treat with that both things aside, how they treat and give credit to the Ukrainians for their resistance and feed them and give them weapons and help them to destroy Russia, the evil. But suddenly, they look the most courageous announcement that said that it might be a genocide, or there might be some evidence that there was an action of genocide. Really? Do you need more blood? We are talking about more than 20,000 child. More than 20,000 child. If you want each day to mention one name, it will take from you more than 30 years just to honor one name each day. So, going back to the question, part of me, I wish everyone who witnessed or shared our misery and this genocide feels the same that we feel right now. ولمسة أمي أحن إلى خبز أمي وقهوتي أمي ولمسة أمي وتكبر في الطفولة يوما على صدري يومي وتكبر في الطفولة يوما على صدري يومي وأعشق عمري لأني إذا مت أخجل من دمعي أمي آه من دمعي أمي
Fatena's boek Uittocht naar Gaza is een bundel van brieven die ze schrijft aan haar lievelingsnichtje, Lamar. Zij kwam een tiental jaar geleden naar België. Toen Fatena in Gaza vorig jaar vastzat, kreeg ze plots een WhatsAppje van Lamar.
Kom zo snel mogelijk terug, alsjeblieft. Ik heb je echt nodig. Ik mis je. Alsjeblieft, ik wil je niet verliezen. Ik wil gewoon dat je terugkomt. Ik smeek je. Als er iets met je gebeurt, zweer ik dat ik het leven niet meer aan kan. Ik heb je hier nodig. Kom alsjeblieft terug. Soms ben jij de enige bij wie ik me op een vreemde manier veilig kan voelen. Alsjeblieft, kom terug. Ik mis je nog erger dan je je kan voorstellen.
Het WhatsAppje van Lamar heeft Fatena diep geraakt en deed haar meteen een belofte doen.
Je kunt je niet inbeelden wat je bericht met me deed, Lamar. Mijn hart werd uit mijn lijf gerukt, alsof de wortels van een boom uit de grond werden gerukt. Ik heb geen controle over deze hele situatie, mijn liefste. Maar ik beloof je dat ik naar jou zal terugkomen. Ook al zal ik te laat zijn om je verjaardag te vieren.
Tell me about, if you like to, about Lamar.
Oh. Of course I like to. I love to talk about Lamar. Lamar, so she will turn 13 years old. Actually, she's a grown up in her mind and in her feelings. So we have a very special communication, a very special bond between me and her. So many talks between both of us. It started when she was very little. When she arrived here, she was like 40 years old. And it started directly, this bond between me and her. She's so open. She's somebody who think a lot, who has a very unique character.
She's, in fact, a niece of
yes.
you.
Yes, she's my niece. And yeah, the love of my life.
Bitil hobbo murril hob.
The day when we evacuate from the hospital to the south, that was not a day. That was not a...
Because of Ahmed.
Because of Ahmed. Because of my mother. And knowing that she has to walk that long without having a risk concerning about her, because what we witnessed when we left the hospital, it was like more than 2 weeks without knowing what's going on around us. When we went to the hospital, our neighborhood was still like it was. Nothing happened. And suddenly when we went out, it was like you enter into a video from the Second World War, you know. Suddenly you enter a portal where it takes you to the Second World War. So, and walking with my mother facing, because each moment with my mother, it was not a moment. I was walking based on her tempo. So carrying my backpack, my other bag on my shoulder, my mother with her weight also laying on my my arm. And so that's why after that, so many things happened at that day. So
yes, you describe it unbelievable in your book. It's very touching. But for the listeners, I have to ask you to make a kind of resume what happened exactly. So let's start with Ahmed. He went for a coffee.
Yeah, Ahmed, the day before leaving the hospital, he was 21, very naughty, very active. Everybody fell in love with him in the hospital. Also, very good looking, with this smile. It blew people away, but their minds away. He was, and he didn't care about anybody. He was like, I know that I'm not for this life, so I will say whatever I want. I'm leaving soon. It was like he was acting this way. And the day before, just one day, like if they just wait a bit, like a few hours, he could be with us. But it wasn't the plan. He went outside without even noticing that he went downstairs. Normally at the door of the hospital, not outside, but at the door of the hospital, sometimes there are people like somebody who makes in the corner, like hidden, a coffee, you know, things to provide it for the people inside. So he took a bucket with fast coffee. And he went outside. And suddenly the news came that Ahmed was shot. In the beginning, they said in his eyes, so... Even when you are threatened the whole time with death and you hear the news about losing people the whole time, and it was just one day before we received the news about my cousin Jawad, and we were still in tears, you know, because of that loss. And but you feel like it's still, death is far away from you. It happens to other people, but it doesn't happen to you. Nobody expect or prepared themselves that death will come so near. So, and then, yani, my brother, he was in the school behind us, because this is the way to provide his family, like feeding them.
It's Mahmoud.
Yeah.
Mahmoud and is the father of Ahmed.
Yes, Mahmoud, the father of Ahmed. So he was in there, and in the beginning, we kept the news away from his mother, because we didn't know, and we thought, okay, he will recover. It's in his eyes. So we start talking about, his uncle. He had an accident when he was young, and he recovered, and we thought he will not recover. So he might have the same luck of his uncle, like this, you know. And then we decide to tell my sister-in-law Palestine. So they ask me to do that. I'm the one who's more like wisdom, in a way, and people respect the way I'm speaking to them. So I went to Palestine and talking a little bit with her. So I told her, I need you for something, but don't be panic. So directly she asked, Ahmed, what's wrong with Ahmed? I was like, calm down, he's okay, he's alive, but he got shot. She didn't give the time to continue to listen to the whole sentence. Yani, while I was telling her that, she was just running on the stairs and me behind her until we arrived to the emergency room. There were Ahmed laying down, still breathing. He was still breathing. And his cousins, two cousins with him, they were brothers, not cousins, two of his friends. And after spending there some time, and I told her, look, he's breathing, so it looks fine, yani, they will take care of him. But there was a look in the eye of the doctor who was standing there. I tried to avoid this look. I tried actually to I refused to believe that look. I ignored it. I don't know why, but it was like, no, this will not happen. Nah. This kind of lost shoe, you don't want to feel it, yani. So we convince her to go upstairs, and he's now okay, and his cousins are with him, and blah blah blah. And I was there for upstairs, returning back to the fourth floor, and after an hour or something, I was sitting with his sisters, and suddenly his two cousins came and said, say Allah irham Ahmed. And I was like, I thought he's telling that it's hopeless. I didn't know in the beginning that he's delivering a news, not ask us to pray for him, that because they lost hope. No, it was he already gone. So I catch him in the hand, very, very tough and hard, until my nails got into his hand. And I said, no, don't say that. And suddenly I heard my sister-in-law scream, and and next day, the first thing we did next day, because my brother, he couldn't come even at that moment, because it was dark, became dark. And when it's dark, it means any movement outside, it means definite death. So his mother was screaming, bring his father, don't bury him without his father. And
I mean, my brother, he couldn't come, of course, that night. We were like just a couple of meters away from each other, but he couldn't come. We got scared because we didn't want to be in one disaster and to became in two, dealing with two. Next day in the morning, I woke up, the voice of Mahmoud, my brother, and he was like trying to hold on. And the first thing he said when he saw me, let me stay strong. Don't cry in front of me. Please help me to stay standing on my feet and strong. Because he know that he has still, we have a long way. So he lost Ahmed, but he don't want to lose the other. So now it's time for action. And we went downstairs in the storage because there was no place in the the fridge or in the hospital. So Ahmed was laying down there with two martyrs, and we said goodbye to him, and then Mahmoud carried Ahmed on his shoulder. He was insisting to bury his son. This sentence doesn't look right. Doesn't look right. And he went to bury him in Al Ahli Hospital because there is a cemetery next to the hospital, belonged to the hospital actually, and his grandmother, he is laying there, so they want to bury him next to his grandmother. And then we agreed to meet because we left also Al-Quds Hospital. We had to leave. My brother's, the other brother with his family, he left before us with the family of my brother Mahmoud. And for me, I was walking at the same tempo of my mother, so that was took longer time, much longer time than my brothers, the two brothers.
You left as lost persons at the hospital.
Yeah. When we left, there was almost nobody, except some patient and injured people staying in the first floor. Beside that, the hospital suddenly was completely empty. So, I walked with my mother like 6.5 hours. Two of them just standing still. She couldn't even sit on a chair. My father carried it with him just to take a breath. Even with this chair, she couldn't sit during the way, like when we were walking, more than just a few seconds to take some breath and to continue walking, because sitting there, it's not an option. You can be bombed just or sniped by somebody, sniper here or there. So just for taking breath. And when we were there, I was talking with my mother just a couple of days ago about that day, actually, about the death people on both sides of the war, the road, people burn in their cars, the soldiers that, you know, the ironic thing about that scene, we were the people who was civilians without any piece of weapon. We were lifting a flag, a white flag, that we are civilians. And we were standing there, most of us, children and women and old people. Of course, there was young people, but most of the people. And yet, they were hiding behind hills of sand, and behind the tanks, and behind, you know, like we are threatening them, you know, when you see it like this. The horror here, nothing looks real. nothing looks real. I was living here in safety and in almost complete silence. And for so long, I never witnessed something like this. And suddenly to be in the middle of everything and in the middle of the most horrific genocide that ever happened to people, because it happens alive. The whole world can witness and see, and still witnessing and seeing. So nothing looks real around us. And we still stand there for 2 hours or more until they force us by cutting our line with their tank, their bulldozer, and making a storm of sands and dust. We suffered so long because of that, from the sand, from coughing, and and after that, we arrived.
كان يونس.
يا.
ما كانش بيصور.
كنا عند فاتنا الغرة الوير. And it will evacuate من outers. مر تو رفح is volmet من and that was صلب دفر حال توني كن خازا was. خانر خان يونس. خان يونس is veilig. خانر خان يونس. Okay. We zijn in خان يونس. Nu gaan naar Rafah. En wat is de volgende stap? Ik wacht op wat precies. Ik ben Jood nu. Ik ben echt Jood. Wacht voor niks. Ik hoop dat iets gaat gebeuren. Ik hoop dat dit genocide zo snel mogelijk stopt. Ik hoop dat die mensen, die overheden en die presidenten in de hele wereld, want iedereen is partner. Jullie zijn partners. De volken zijn met de Palestijnse. Maar overheden, we zien niks. Behalve toen Israël. Tegen mensen. Gewoon armloze mensen. Dus wat vraag ik? Dat dit genocide, dit groot genocide, te stoppen zo snel mogelijk. En we kunnen terug, iedereen kan terug naar hun huis, als er is nog huis.
Ik registreer nu, ik en mijn moeder en mijn vader, naar evacueren naar Rafah, want ik ga niet mijn moeder hetzelfde scenario van Gaza, van El Quds, Arganiones herhalen, terug herhalen. Minstens nu. Er is nog rode weg tussen Khan Yunis en Rafah, maar de volgende dagen weten niet. Misschien hetzelfde scenario van Gaza zal gebeuren. En nu kan mijn moeder minstens rustig naar Rafah gaan. Ik hoop dat de weg is veilig. Inshallah, we komen aan Rafah veilig en goed.
Soldater och poliser.
Soldater och poliser.
Och vi De podcast van EPO.